Welcome to Engineering Innovations, the official podcast of Purdue University's Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering. I'm your host, Kristen Malavenda, Communications Director for Purdue ECE. In each episode, we explore the groundbreaking research and the minds behind it, showcasing the cutting-edge work that's shaping our world. And today, I'm joined by Dr. Jing Gao. She's Associate Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering, and she's at the forefront of data science research, tackling some of the biggest challenges in making AI models more understandable and efficient. Her work has implications for everything from medical diagnoses to the AI we use on our smartphones. We'll dive into her innovative approaches to making machine learning more reliable, how she's improving the efficiency of massive language models, and what it all means for the future of technology. Jing, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So let's start off with sharing a bit about your journey into the world of data science and what led you to your current research here at Purdue.
Sure. It went back to when I was a senior in college. So at that time, I majored in computer engineering. And then our department had this program that basically admitted like top students based on the GPA directly into the master thesis program.
Yep.
And I was selected. But at that time, I didn't do any research. I don't have any prior research experiences. I have no preferences over topics or areas. But I need to find an advisor. So basically, I chose my advisor based on reputation.
Yeah.
So my master thesis advisor, he is a excellent researcher,
yeah.
And he works on in database field. And then I joined his lab. And at that time, he just started a project on data mining. So then I joined that project. And then since then, I have been working in data science. But I really like it. I think that's a fantastic field. And then, for data science, it's basically data mining in particular, tries to learn patterns, extract knowledge from huge amounts of data. And then in order to do that, we use statistical methods, we use machine learning methods. So that's why my research gradually evolves into the world of machine learning, artificial intelligence.
Right.
So right now at Purdue, we work on basically addressing challenges efficiency, reliability, and so basically those challenges with respect to AI models.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And you mentioned your work involves making machine learning models more understandable and more efficient. Why is that important, especially as AI becomes more a part of our everyday lives?
Yeah, sure. So I think we now have seen so many success usage of AI models in our everyday lives. So for example, Amazon, when you go to Amazon purchase products or you watch YouTube videos, so then they keep recommending stuff
right.
to you. So then the underlying model is basically AI model. They learn from your historical data and then try to recommend something that you might be interested in. But in those scenarios, it's okay to make mistakes, right? So they recommend something you don't like, it's fine.
Yep.
But when we use AI models in some other domains, like you mentioned, like medical diagnosis, we have really low or zero tolerance of mistakes,
right?
So then in those scenarios, we cannot just directly deploy AI models to make the final decision, but rather AI models have to work together with human beings, doctors, right?
Yeah.
They need to work together to come up with the solution. So then in that sense, the AI models have to be understandable by human beings, by doctors. And then for the efficiency part, that's definitely also very important dimension of AI models, because we know right now AI models are become bigger and bigger. Again, this is fun in some applications, some scenarios.
Right.
But some other applications, we don't have that resources, we don't have the storage, we don't have the time to wait. So then in those scenarios, we need to have efficient AI
right.
models.
Gotcha. Yeah. You talk about interpreting a machine learning model. What exactly does that mean? And why is it important to understand why that model is making a certain decision?
So again, if we use healthcare, medical diagnosis as an example, when we don't want AI models to directly output, just say yes or no. So for example, we are analyzing huge amounts of electronic health records. Mm-hmm. And then the AI models can like output some prediction, like whether this particular patient has this disease or not. But we don't want just AI models to give that final output.
Right.
But instead, we want to like the AI models give the reasoning process, like why like you judge this patient have this disease.
Right.
Is there like related to some risk factors or some symptoms the patient has or some like measurement values? So give those reasons behind those decisions. That's very important because again, we want the AI models to work together with the doctor right. to make the final decision. So then providing yes or no answer is not very helpful,
right.
but providing all those information to doctors would be very helpful.
Yeah, because if I put into Netflix or something and it suggests movies to me or whatever, it doesn't matter if it's something I don't like.
Yeah,
but if it's
yeah.
somebody's health.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a very critical decision,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You've researched how AI explanations can be manipulated. Can you explain what a data poisoning attack is and how it might affect the reliability of an AI model's decision?
So basically for like machine learning model is trained on some data set. So we call it training data. And then training data basically consists of a set of records. And then for data poisoning attack, so our goal is actually to like act as an attacker, try to explore the vulnerabilities of those models. So the traditional scenario is like the model is just trained on this training data. So there is no poisoning at all.
Right.
And then you get a model and the model make predictions. But for data poisoning attack, we want to like inject some like fake records or we change the values of some records and then the model will change accordingly. And then if you use the model for predictions for output, the output will change accordingly.
Gotcha.
So this is basically data poisoning attack. But we work on like data poisoning attack on like some challenging scenarios like interpretation or some other. So basically why we want to study this data poisoning attack is because it helps us understand the so-called robustness of the machine learning model. Because like in real life, when you collect training data, it may not be complete, may not be perfect, right? So if there is some slight change in the data, then your whole model will change and everything changes. And then we'll say the model is not robust enough. It's not good. But if the model is robust enough, like it's not sensitive to those changes, that's a better quality of machine learning model.
Gotcha.
So, but we try to explore from the attacker point
right.
of view.
You're trying to create
create
issues. And then
issues.
Out how
yeah,
to,
yeah.
To
and then like maybe people can explore like how to like make their models
right.
more robust.
That makes
yeah.
sense.
Yeah.
So you developed a new tool called the Interpretation Manipulation Framework. How does that help uncover weaknesses in AI models?
Yeah, so for that one, we basically focus on so-called interpretation of machine learning model. So for data poisoning attack, there are like many people studying this data poisoning attack, but they focus on manipulating the model output. Like they inject some, we call malicious samples into the training data, and then the model output will change. So for example, like, we consider like image classification. Mm-hmm. Like we have a bunch of images. We want to distinguish cats from dogs.
Okay.
And then the traditional data poisoning attack. So they just inject some fake images. Then like the model output like will change from cat to dog or dog to cat.
Right.
But we work on interpretation. So basically for interpretation, what people does is they try to associate some like weights with the feature values that can indicate like why the decision is made.
Okay.
So for example, the cat dog image classification task. So they try to highlight the regions, like which part leads to the decision. Like this is a cat image, this is dog image, for example, some body parts,
right.
for example. And then what we did in that work is basically try to poison that part. So we try to inject fake images or fake samples into the training data such that that region, it's changed. So the model right. outputs may not change. So it's still like a cat still classified cat, dogs still classify that dog, but that region mm-hmm. will change accordingly.
Gotcha.
So this can help us like understand better the robustness of those interpretation models.
Gotcha. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, you're mm-hmm. trying to give it as much information as possible so it can...
Yeah, but you give wrong information.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's kind of fun though to try to cause problems.
Yeah.
You also created a solution called Light Token to make these large models smaller without losing their effectiveness. How does it work? Mm. And how will it affect how we use AI on our mobile devices?
Mm-mm. So for that part of work, we focus on the efficiency of deep learning models or large language models because they are like growing bigger and bigger.
Right.
But for those models, they are typically like they are simply like a stack of different layers. And then the layers, each layer is simply like typically represented as some sort of matrix.
Okay.
So basically we are working on this matrix compression, or I think a more appropriate word is we call it sparsification. So we are actually not changing the size of the matrix, mm-hmm. but hopefully we get more zeros in the matrix.
Okay.
So like there are like just a few like non-zero entries in the matrix, and then the others are zeros.
Okay.
So that is called sparsification. So this matrix sparsification has been started for a long time. So people have some effective methods or techniques developed. One way is to do this matrix factorization. So basically approximate the matrix by a product of two like smaller or sparse matrices.
Okay.
And then there is a method called quantization. So basically like map some of the values into binary codes. So
okay.
because binary codes, they just like very efficient to mm-hmm. store. So we basically use a combination of these techniques together, but we place them in the context of this deep learning model training process. So it's not like
right.
easy
yeah,
when you
yeah.
put them into that context. So we basically like develop those optimization strategies and then the training strategies basically like combining those compression or sparsification methods inside. And then we demonstrate that using our method, the like token approach, so we can like significantly reduce the number of non-zero entries
okay.
In the matrix. And then basically it occupies less storage. And then like the bigger model, basically you can store on like some small devices.
Right. Yeah. Because everybody's always looking for more storage like on their computer
yeah,
and on their
yeah,
smartphones
yeah.
and whatnot. And or they're being suggested by someone, do you want to buy more storage? That's what they're doing. So, excuse me, a lot of AI models can be slow because they have to go through so many steps and layers of processing. And now you created another method called HadSkip, and that helps speed it up. How does it decide which steps to skip and why does it make the model faster?
Sure. So for HadSkip, again, it works with deep learning models. Deep learning models, as I mentioned, is just layers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the traditional deep learning models is just like they have all these layers. When you suppose the model is already trained, and then when you use the model for like predictions or inference, so when you use the model, so you need to traverse all the layers.
Okay.
Like after this layer, go to next,
yep.
and go to next, and that's it. And then what we did is we changed the design of the model by adding a gate to each layer.
Okay.
So basically the gate is we call it binary gate, so it just, the output is just 0 or 1. And then basically when it's 1 means that we won't skip, so we'll go to the next layer. When it's 0, so it will skip.
Okay.
So it will go to the next layer. And then when the next layer, we have another gate, and then we'll keep judging whether we should skip or
yep.
we should go. And then we add that part into the deep learning model. And again, the challenge is like learning all these.
Right.
So we still need to learn the deep learning model And now we still need, we also need to learn the gate value.
Right.
So basically we design some optimization strategies so that we can learn all these parameters together based on our training data. And then once it's learned, then the gate has those 0, 1 values. Okay. And then we can use it for predictions. So then basically, like, when we traverse the layers, when the gate value is 0, we will skip. So in this way, we can skip those layers.
Right,
yeah, and make it faster.
And it's, and you're talking about these decisions being made, like, nanoseconds or something. It's not it's not taking time to consider it.
It's automatic, basically.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I know along the way you mentioned your first advisor and you chose that advisor because of their reputation.
Yeah.
And you've probably now mentored many students in your academic career. What is the importance of mentors and how do you mentor your students? What does that look like for you?
Yeah. So I'm very thankful to all the mentors I have throughout my academic journey. So including like my master advisor, PhD advisor, and also like some senior students who helped me when I was in the lab, senior colleagues when I started as a faculty. So many mentors helped me. And I think mentors definitely very, very important. And so for example, like during PhD, mentors help, for example, help me like guiding me through the choosing the topics, choosing the research directions, develop those basic research skills. As I mentioned, when I started, I have no prior research experience.
Right.
It's basically like start from scratch.
Yep.
And then and also like providing feedback, constant feedback to what you did, your research progress, and also provide the emotional support.
Right.
Like when I got my papers rejected,
yes,
like
you want
someone to comfort you, that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then like provide career support, like help you establish networks, like social with others, like write letters, support letters.
Yeah.
I think mentors are definitely like very, very important. And I try to follow what they did to mentor my students.
Yeah.
And then for my students, especially like PhD students, I work with them like all the 5 years. It's actually a long time.
Yeah, it is.
And I think one important lesson I found when mentoring students is you know, it's like when the students join you, you usually put them on some research project.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also important at the same time, think about the long-term plan,
right.
Long-term goal. Talk with the student, discuss with students, like what do you want to do after graduation?
Yep.
What's your interest? And then learn about the student's skill sets, like what knowledge he has, he or she has or she does not have.
Right.
And then try to recommend some courses and some like materials for the student to improve on the part that...
To fill those gaps.
Yeah, fulfill those gaps. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then some students, like the English writing skills are not that good yet. So
mm-hmm.
like... ask them to refine that skill.
Right.
That's also important.
Yeah.
Like think about the plan. So some students like they say, oh, I want to join industry after graduation.
Right.
And some students say, oh, I want to like join as a faculty.
Yeah.
And the skill sets are somewhat different, right? So basically design those individual long-term plan for the students. I think that's very, very helpful. And the student can change mind, right? So
right.
some students like before he said, oh, I want to do like go to industry, but later said, I want to join academia. But
yeah.
that's totally fine.
Yeah.
But I think when the students start, it's great to have that plan
right.
in mind.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How did you decide to go into academia as opposed to industry?
So basically, I think the main reason is I enjoy research.
Mm.
And I think one big advantage of doing research in academia is the freedom.
Right.
Like the freedom of choosing topics and what you research on. I think that's really valuable.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And also anything I really like is basically mentoring students,
yeah.
So interact with students. Because I think the students are usually at the frontier of doing research. So like right now, I think I'm constantly learning from my students.
Right.
They bring new ideas, they bring all those new trends. So I'm learning from them.
That's
I think
right.
that's also another like very nice thing about academia.
So
yeah.
when you're maybe interviewing students or talking to students and considering taking them on as your PhD student,
mm.
What qualities do you look for in a student that make you think that they'll be a successful PhD student?
So I think the most important quality is basically this motivation and like strong passion for research. If we like really love research, and even though like, for example, some students, the technical background, when they start, the technical background is not strong enough. But if they are eager to learn, they are eager to improve, then you see like amazing progress they made. So I think that's definitely the most important quality. But the challenge is actually to identify that quality, like, because it's really hard to find that from applications. I think like interviews may help. And also especially, I think another important source is like through recommendations from faculty that you know. That's also like a good source. But sometimes it's simply just guessing.
Because you don't really know what someone's like until you're actually working
That could be another like a great source. Like you work with the students, like starting from the master or undergrad, and then you know the students is very good, and then you can recruit that student.
So in research, of course, you have probably more failures than you do successes. How do you teach your students that that's okay, like that's part of the process and to not get discouraged?
I think it's really like you need to give them time to like, I think that's happened to probably almost all the students. Like when the first paper was rejected, that's really like a big hit for for all the students. Like but I like use my experience to tell them that it's fine. Like later, definitely, if it's a good work, you'll definitely accept it somewhere. So just keep doing good work, and then submit the work somewhere. That's fine. That's totally fine. But you know, like people need time to like adjust to that.
Absolutely.
So typically, like after maybe a few papers, they are fine. But usually, like the beginning phase, they need some time to adjust. Well, just give them the time.
Right, like, and that's the importance, like you said, of mentors. Because when they don't get it accepted, then you say that's all right.
Just tell them it's okay. Yeah. Like, but typically, like after a few papers, it's okay. So I have a student. When he first joined us, the first paper he got rejected, he was so depressed and said, oh, I don't want to do research anymore. And I said, it's fine. Like we just like modify the paper based on reviewers' comments and then we just resubmit. And later this paper got accepted by some like other conference that is even like have better reputation.
Wow.
Like,
that's great.
Also,
you guys do a lot of interdisciplinary research now. What's the importance of working with other areas? And in data science, what are some of the areas that you work with the most?
So for data science, it's definitely very, very important to work with other areas because I imagine myself as some like data analytics solution provider, right? So basically for those real application domains, they have their data and then they have their goals, like what they want to achieve out of the data, like what insights they want to find from the data to help with their decisions. So they give us the problem, they give us the data, they give us the problem. And then often we find that those existing methods like machine learning, AI models, may not be the best solution. So we try to find the best solutions. So that's what we do. So therefore, the like working with those application domains are very important. So I don't actually have one particular focus domains, but rather I just work with like people when they come to me with their task, with their problem. So I have worked on like transportation domains. I worked in with people from so right now I have a project on criminal justice. So try to like collect those criminal justice data from open government portal. And then try to provide this infrastructure for those criminal justice experts to look through the data, do their research. And I have ongoing collaboration with faculty in College of Agriculture. So we work on this gene expression data. So it's like plant biology problem. And then in the past, I also worked on this healthcare task. So we analyzing this electronic health records to, like you said, assist medical diagnosis.
Right.
Yeah.
So you really get to work in
Yeah, all these different domains. And it's fun.
Yeah.
Like you get to know those areas. And they all tell me like how important you guys are. Like when we started on this criminal justice project, and we have a criminal justice on expert on team, and he constantly mentioned to us like, oh, right now our research, so they are doing like criminal justice research, but they don't have the knowledge, the data that needed to help their research.
Gotcha.
And then he constantly tell us like how important you guys are. And
that's great.
Yeah, feel great.
Yeah, because you feel to keep going.
Yeah,
too,
yeah, like, exactly. Yeah. So not only making impacts in our field, but like try to bring impacts to their fields.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I know research is a big part of your life. When you're not in the lab or mentoring students or teaching classes, what do you like to do in your free time just to relax and have fun?
So I have a daughter, 7 year old. So my, I think, leisure time, just send her around her maybe.
Yes.
So like taking her to museum, taking her to like some playgrounds, fun places, or extracurricular activities. So basically like my life is like that.
I totally get that.
Yeah.
When they're little, they kind of rule what you do.
Yeah, yeah. But I enjoy the fact that, first off, Purdue have lots of events, activities.
Yeah.
It's a fun place.
It really is.
And then we are not that far from Indy or even Chicago.
Yeah.
So sometimes we go there to like
a lot of cultural and educational
opportunities. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we have very nice museums.
Absolutely.
Like in Indy or Chicago.
Yeah. Yes. Well, great. Mm-hmm. That wraps up today's episode of Engineering Innovations. We're the official podcast of Purdue University's Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering. And thank you so much, Jingao, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
If you'd like to learn more about this research or explore other cutting-edge projects happening here at Purdue, you can go to our website. That's purdue.edu/ECE. You can follow us on social media or on all the socials, and our links to those things can be found in the show notes. Thanks so much for listening, and remember to subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. I'll be back next month with more stories of innovation and discovery from the world of electrical and computer engineering.